It's a shell game. It's like, where is it? Yeah. And if they, I don't know, that's what's the problem with it, is like, what is the process? Do you go to college and never know how to graduate? Never know what you have to accomplish before you can be accepted, be certified, or get what you want? But that's kind of the process that Indian people have been in this whole time. It's like the recognition process. There's no clear way to do it. It's like everybody kind of, you know, it's kind of like saying, write me a paper, and not giving you any parameters to say, well, I want it to be a comedy. Oh, this is too dramatic, so that I'm rejecting that. Now I've changed. You know, I want a children's story. I didn't want a comedy. You know, keep changing it. Like, you keep writing, but you never know how to get to the other side. Or they come back and say, well, you used a pencil. We wanted it in blue ink. You know, it's stuff like that that doesn't make sense. You know, I just found out yesterday that the Talawa Nation was denied federal recognition because the government came back and said, well, you had a weak spot between your leaderships and time. It's like, well, was that the time that you were all killing us? That you killed the leader of that generation? Is that the time that there was a length of time before another leader took over? And they don't take any acknowledgement of the history that was caused here in California. Because this is the only state that they actually made a policy of killing Indians. That was their way of taking care of California Indians. You know, in other states, they killed them, but their state government didn't actually make a law that says, we'll pay you for killing them. You know, like here in California, which makes California totally different than a lot of states' histories. And because we have such an abundance, like all of these rivers in California, all these mountains, made for separate groups of Indian people to exist, you know, in their own realm, as opposed to, you know, folks following the buffalo, you know, where you had to go vast amounts of land to make everything work. And here, you know, self-sufficiency on this river, you don't have to go anywhere else if you don't want to, right? But there were trade routes, there were places that medicines, you know, people would call for doctors to come over different places. But all around here, like our Hoopa neighbors, they speak Athabascan. Their language is Athabascans. Ours is Penutian. The Pitt Rivers that spoke yesterday that came down, theirs is Hokan. And so they're very different languages. It's not like even similar. So you have pockets of people who exist and do things in a different way and have totally different languages, that bringing them all together, like, it's like, when you California Indians get together, you know, maybe we can do something. It's like, well, that's like saying, well, German, China, and Russia, if you guys can get together and speak the same language, we'll be able to do something for you.
So in that context, can you describe why the war dance is happening? How did you come about even calling a war dance, and for what purpose?
Yeah, the things that we do are prayed about. Like, before this war dance even was thought of, that we've gone up to Cold Spring Mountain, we've gone to the secret places, we have been working on this both in the legal sense and in the spiritual. And we're trying to do everything that makes sense. Like, we've done all the paperwork legally, we've researched, we've given the Forest Service every avenue that we thought might be an authority that they could use to close the river. We've did the research, we've had attorneys send them explaining the authority that they have to close the river. regardless of recognition or not recognized, just based on people's rights. And then we have prayed about it. We've gone to our fires. And this is the result on the spiritual side, is to do this war dance. But the war dance is like an opening to ask for direction, to ask for things to open up to change this. That's what a hopchonis is, but it translates into war dance, and people have a different concept of war than what Indian people have a concept of war. War in Indian country doesn't mean we go out and kill everybody else. You know, not like the concept of war of the United States. In the beginning, that, you know, when the Civil War was, they just went out and killed everybody, or as many as they could on either side. But Indians don't fight that way. The wars that they talk about are more like humility. Like, if I can touch my enemy, it brings them humility, and then I win. I don't have to kill them, because now they're going to behave themselves, because they don't want to be humiliated. But you make a point about it, you know. And so it's a different way of maneuvering, you know. But we have a lot of those misconceptions, and the language, the English language, doesn't always give a good enough definition when it's translated from our language. It's kind of like, you know, I'm chief of the Winnemowinchu tribe, right, and spiritual leader. But in reality, in my language, I would be a Tlahit. And a Tlahit is a person that comes up from the back of the tribe that people follow. It's not like you even want to be a leader. It's not like, if you ask Marissa, the next leader, does she want to be the leader? If she's striving for that, if she's living her life like, I'm going to be their leader and they better like it. It's not like that. It's like you don't even know how you're going to be a leader. But as things unfold, as places you go and pray, the elders that talk with you and tell you, and you start going along that line, and then everybody kind of follows that. And so you get to be a leader. And a Tlahit is that kind of person. And it's not like they all voted for me and now I'm the leader, you know, because they voted for me. It's a lifelong way that you live. And if you get to get out the other end, then it's kind of your responsibility to take that up. You don't really have that option to say, well, I don't really want to. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to move to Australia. It's like, that in itself is a destruction to the tribe. If the leaders that have been worked with and schooled to be that, educated, given the gifts, turn their backs, then, you know, that's almost unheard of, that they would even think to do that, because it would destroy the person in them. Because they live a certain way of life. But it also, you know, in the modern world, it's like, you know, you can't be recalled. You can't quit. You know, it's a lifetime commitment. It's not like, well, for these next 4 years, I'm going to do these things and boast about, you know, all the things you're going to do for those people. You don't do that. You know, because one, you live with the people. You're one of the people. Everything that happens to you, people, happens to you. And
so, how do you get your direction? How do you know how to lead your people?
From the sacred. It's from the elders. It's from watching, like my grams was leader of the tribe for 68 years. And I followed her, you know, and because I was going to be a next leader, I was in on some of the very personal things that she dealt with. You know, her own disappointments of how the lake was lost, how her family was, the distraught position of her dad and her mom. You know, her daughter was handicapped. You know, she was born blind. And so there was a lot of personal issues that she dealt with also, aside from bringing out all the love for her people, you know, and accepting and directing and the patience to even continue dealing with the government, or, you know, fighting for these places that I think that's a training or a lessons in your life that you never forget. You know, it's kind of like when they're talking, there's more than listening going on. You know, there's places in you that gets stored, and you don't know 20 years from now, you're going to repeat exactly what was said at that time. You're not conscious of that. You know, you hear it and you think about it, and maybe you don't even understand it for 5 years. And then all of a sudden you remember it, and it's like, oh yeah. And then you start talking about it again. But you don't know at the time, and it's like you're not taking notes and saying, okay, I'm going to use that in the future. You know? So it's kind of that kind of preparation, like Graham said when we were in transition. And I said, well, you know, I don't think I'm going to be the kind of leader you are. And she said, you're not supposed to be. You're going to be your own leader, because those are your peers. Those are, just like when Marissa swims across with the people that she's going to swim with, those are her helpers, those are her peers. And it's of her generation. Everything that happens on the other side, that her protectors are of her generation. It's not my generation. It's not the older guys that are going to be protecting her. It's those who will live the length of life that she should live that will be her protectors and provider. You know, and so it's like, okay, so maybe no, everybody's not going to like me. And she goes, that doesn't even matter, that you start off with those who will follow, because they're so used to following her that it's a transition for them too. You know, even though she's saying this is the new leader, everybody has to get to a place of accepting that, and whether or not they can. And she said, some people are here just because of me, of who I am. But some people are here because they believe in that sacred fire. They believe in these sacred places. They believe in these dances. And those are the people who will follow you, because they have the big picture. It's not all about me. It's not about this person. It's about this land we walk on. It's about this mountain and our relationship to it. And those who can hang on to that, they're the ones that you want to follow. You want them to be with you. You know, that's what it's about. It's not about being popular or anything about personal, you know, that you want people to have. You know, you're trying to empower them by giving them the sense that when that war dancer puts his foot on that ground, that they can feel it. And that's the part, you know, that makes us leaders. And that's the part we're trying to help Marissa with, you know, that she will be. And she's already got some of that stuff, you know. So she already knows, feels it, and knows it, and sees it, you know. So even though, you know, some people, it always surprises me. It's like some people say, well, how come she don't get an interview, or she won't give, you know, speaking or going out? And it's like, we're not required to do that. We're not even supposed to do that until later on. You know, we're not boasting about, you know, I'm the next leader of my tribe. I'm going to do this. And when I get to be leader, you know, or you all should follow me or whatever. You don't do that. You know, it's not part of our training. You know, and nobody really wants to be the leader. You're training to be it, but you don't think it's ever going to happen, because you don't want that leader to ever end. You know, just like Graham's. I started my training with her probably, that I actually knew. Like, Marissa didn't know when she was born that she was in training. But just now, she knows she's in training. So she's an active participant.
That's 17 years later. How did you know that she was going to be the next chief?
Oh, the way that she was born into the world. She came in 3 weeks early at our Coonrod ceremony, which is on Mount Shasta, which is one of our most powerful places of prayer. And she came at sunrise. Like, that's when we're out asking the Creator to help us, to look at us, to give us that spiritual base, and she's on her way. And she comes out feet first. And she has, you know, just in that, bringing her to us like that, tells us this is somebody that we really got to pay attention to. This is just not no normal baby. This is somebody special sent by the Creator to help us. And those are all signs that, you know, we can't just slough off and say, oh yeah, it's just coincidence, or it's just, you know, something that happened.
So we're here on the McLeod River,
mm-hmm,
at the Shasta Trinity National Forest with the Winnemem Wintu tribe. They're holding a war dance. Mm-hmm. And this is Radio Curious. I'm Christina Onnested, and I'm speaking with the chief and spiritual leader of the Winnemem Wintu, Colleen Sisk Franco. You may be hearing in the background some, what it is it's a motorboat, and it's driving past on the river. And this is a sacred location. This is a historical ancestral lands to the Winnemem Wintu. This is where you come to hold your sacred fire, to hold your ceremonies. How is it for you to have this experience of a sacred ceremonial, spiritual place, ceremony, with people riding by on boats and mm-hmm, blasting music, mm-hmm, sometimes drinking beer, shouting, as yep, we've seen in the past? How is
well,
that?
I think that if people could imagine being in a sermon at the Vatican, and somebody comes down the aisle riding a Harley Davidson, and they're trying to listen to the choir, how would people feel about that? You know, is it an interruption? I think so. Does it break the harmony of the blessings, of the prayers? Yeah, it does. And the same thing here. But people can't recognize. I mean, people would recognize right off that a Harley Davidson has no business being in the Vatican. But they don't recognize it here, that this is our Vatican. And that when motorboats come up this river, you know, on their holiday, that it is disruptive. And whether or not they have rights to do that above our rights to hold a ceremony is still being tossed around, you know, whether or not we're the ones who have to adjust. We're the ones who have to allow it all the time. But they don't have to stop coming up the river, ever. But that's what this war dance is about, is like we're bringing our next chief into her womanhood. Our ceremony requires her to be across the river and swim back through the river to the other side, where she will take her place among the women first. And whenever a boat comes through, it causes disruption, even in the sound of it. The waves on the water causes things to change. Everything is disrupted. From her hearing it to us feeling it, the vibrations of that boat, whatever oils are dropping off that boat, the fish that are getting out of the way of that boat, changes things. It's just like when she's out and she's going upriver and she sees the eagle come. That changes it for her. Because even with the eagle coming through, he's sending off energy. He's making an appearance. What she sees, what she feels. If he hollers, what that means, you know, to it. And it changes it all. But those are the changes that we want her to have. But when the boats come up, the fishermen are, you know, people are yelling at us, that's not the change that we want her to have. We don't want her to have to deal with that, because it interrupts the spiritual base that the next chief will get from this mountain, from all the creation that's here. So we want to diminish that. You know, and we're not sure how to ask for that.
And you've asked the U.S. Forest Service to close the river, and they've refused to close the river to the public during your ceremony, which is this puberty ceremony, the coming-of-age ceremony for your next tribal chief, is once in her lifetime, happens, yep, maybe once a year.
Yep. It not only happens, you know, once in her lifetime, but the fact that she will be responsible for future generations doing the exact same thing that she did. And she will be in charge of the next chief coming through. And if it is a woman, that woman will have to go through this exact same thing. And she's learning what we're doing. She's learning maybe we can fix it by then and she won't have to deal with it. And maybe the next chief after her will be a man and it won't be done this way. But, you know, looking at our next generations and even our right to be here now, to survive this day and age, to be able to still know that this is what we should be doing. This is how we do it. This is the songs that go with this. You know, it's pretty magical that this still exists. But it seems like, you know, California, the people in California, the federal government, it means nothing. It means absolutely nothing other than that they didn't kill us all. You know, and we still have to deal with the Indians. You know, we have this.
For people who are just listening and maybe are unfamiliar with the terrain here, could you describe this here McLeod River and the surrounding waterways? Is this like a once-in-a-lifetime river to go down in your boat? Is this the sole river here where we're at?
This is one of three rivers, large rivers, that flow into the McLeod, into the Lake Shasta. They've covered up over 26 miles of this river with the lake already. Part of the stretch that we're on is where the McLeod River comes into the lake, meaning no boats can go up above where they come in. So it's not a throughway. It's not like there's another 5-10 miles that they could boat up river because the river only runs at 200 CSFs, which is unnavigable by boats, by motorboats or houseboats or ski boats. You know, it isn't appropriate. They can't even maneuver it. And so the area that we're talking about, because McLeod River is a canyon river, mostly now, that all of the flatland and all of the wider areas of the river are now under the lake. So the area here is already limited by a 5-mile-an-hour buoy that's posted probably 500 yards down from the bridge, McLeod River Bridge. And basically, you know, they can't really ski in here. They can't pull tubes behind them. They can't, you know, you can't make a wake here. But even that boat that went out, they were making a wake. They're not supposed to make a wake. But nobody stops them from making a wake. It's like, oh, well. You know, but there's a reason that they're not supposed to make a wake. But in addition to, you know, our needs as a tribe here, that we have been asking the Forest Service to close this off, the motorboats in the first place, because it's a sensitive area where the environment changes because you have a natural river flowing into a lake. The temperature changes for the fish, for the otters, for the geese. There shouldn't be. I mean, the wildlife here should be protected from ski boats, motorboats, you know, dropping of oil here. But, you know, can't see it.
And you're asking a 400-yard closure right in this region.
Right. We're asking from the bridge to the buoy, basically, which is a 5-mile-an-hour zone, and they can't go any farther north of it for 4 days for this ceremony to take place in peace and dignity.
And the Forest Service has refused to grant you that request. So,
yeah,
what
you know,
what kind of a message is it?
Yeah, the message is like, I don't really know if refusal is what they're doing. It feels like that, but they haven't said it. They haven't admitted it. They haven't said, no, we are denying closing off the river. But they keep saying, fill out this permit. You have to have a permit. And so we filled out the permit. We submitted it. Now they're saying it's incomplete. So we update it. We add a couple more sentences. This says how many people will be in the water every day. And then they come back and say, no, that's incomplete. Now you have to deal with the campground concessionaire and work that out. And we actually have worked it out with the concessionaire that he needs to make $1,500 to reserve this campground for the ceremony people. And now they say that permit has nothing to do with closing the river. So even if we get the permit, it doesn't mean they'll close the river. And we don't know what that process is. They don't share that. Like, what is the process for applying to close the river? Or how do we engage in dialogue to close the river? How does that happen? Is it just like willy-nilly and all of a sudden somebody in the Forest Service decides that it's okay to close the river? Is it based on our reputation? Are we real Indians? Do we deserve to close the river? Because in past ceremonies, they've offered us a voluntary closure, which we thought was attached to the permit. But obviously not, that was something different or came about in a different way that we didn't even understand. But we know that voluntary closures don't work. In fact, they almost let the worst people in the world through, because everybody who has a decent way of life and knowing what's right and wrong and feeling respect for different people's ways, they turn around and go back. But those with an agenda to express their rights to recreation, to whatever it is that they hold contempt for, they're up here. They're yelling, you know, obscenities. They're challenging us the whole time. Even one woman flashed her breast to the bank of children and ceremonial grounds. The people were there. For what? You know, why? Why would that be necessary? Because nobody was yelling at them, even though they were disrupting the ceremony. No one challenged them. No one, you know, no one threw rocks at them. But yet, they felt like they needed to share that. Just out of the blue. It's like, oh yeah, we need to show our breasts to those people on the bank. Because, why? Proud of it? Or she thinks nobody on the bank has breasts? Or she's the only one that needs to show them to the guys? Or what is it? Who thinks like that?
So you're having the war dance, and part of that is you're preparing to blockade this river with your supporters for your next ceremony. Is that correct?
We don't want to do that. We would much rather that there be respect for our way of life and that there be a 4-day closure of this stretch of the river. But because we're backed into the corner now, we've pulled Marissa out of 2 different ceremonies already because we could not get the river closed. That it's so important to us that she have every spiritual experience here without interruption, because motorboats bring her nothing. The disruption of yelling at us shouldn't be in her coming of age. So we are preparing to close the river should the Forest Service feel like they can't, feel like they don't want to, feel like it's not important enough, feel like we don't have any rights, because right now they're saying, well, you're not a recognized tribe. If we were a recognized tribe, the Farm Bill is a law that they could use to close the river. Maybe. We don't even know what they can do. We don't even know who in the Forest Service has the power to do anything. We've gone up the chain and back down the chain. You know, we went all the way to Randy Moore's office in Vallejo to ask him to use his authority to close the river for 4 days, the 400-yard stretch that we're asking for. And he's basically sent us back down the line. He never responded to a person on the staff that's below the ranger on the lake, below the forest supervisor. And he has failed to interact on any level. He didn't even introduce her. If she is, we don't even know if she is the staff person that he's assigned to work with us or not. She just apparently appeared out of a Samuel Cave restoration project. And now all of a sudden, you know, she's somebody that we've never worked with before. She's not anybody that we've interacted or know what to expect from her. You know, but she's not the ranger. She's below Christy Cattini, who's the ranger on the lake, below Sharon Haywood, who we'd been working with and trying to get this closure for since 2005.
Have you talked with any of the elected representatives, congress members, senators?
We have worked with Senator Boxer's office for a number of years trying to get this closed. Her chief of staff joined us for the 2011 meeting that we had trying to get this ceremony underway. And still, while the senator seems supportive of doing the right thing here, she has not been effective in making that happen the way that we're asking. We've gone to Herger's office. We've gone to the county supervisors. Glenn Hawes has indicated that he would be supportive, but the county supervisors have no jurisdiction on addressing the closure of the lake. So it's like everywhere we turn, people don't seem to have the authority. And for a couple of years, we didn't know if it was the sheriff's office who had the authority to close the area, or was the Forest Service, or is it the Bureau of Reclamation who seemed to own the lake? You know, who actually has that authority?
That must be frustrating.
Very frustrating.
How is it for you?
Yeah, it's incredible, you know, because I read one of the people said that Randy Moore, who is the regional supervisor for not only this forest, but a number of forests, didn't know anything about this until we went to Vallejo and knocked on his door. It's like, how does a supervisor of region not know about a people who have won a lawsuit against the Forest Service? You'd think he'd be up on that and know who we were. And two, a people who have been asking this same question since 2005 and has been in the media, writing to the Forest Service, addressing the Forest Service, sending information to him to say that he didn't know. But I think that's a cop-out.
Could you give us, we're going to wrap it up soon. Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us a little bit of a history about this place here that we're at?
This is an old dance area. It's Kai Bay. It's called Kai Bay Village. And it goes on both sides of the river. On the other side of the river is the Puberty Rock. And it sits below the Two Sisters Mountain. That's all important to the ceremony. The ceremonies can only be done during a full moon and when the flowers are out. All of these things have to be in place for this ceremony to take its rightful direction for these young women to come across. And so while, you know, some people think, oh, you shouldn't have picked 4th of July weekend, it's like, well, we didn't really pick it. The full moon picked it. And because our dance ground, you can see our dance ground is underwater right now, and we're waiting for it, we would just as soon have that ceremony this month or even last month because there's more flowers. July is the tail end of the flowers. There's barely anything left. And in August, all of the flowers are gone. So we can't really extend into August. You know, July is our month because it's underwater right now. You know, I don't think people realize that we're already tolerating the changes, and we're trying to make the best of it. And it's too bad.
Why is it underwater?
They retain water for the rest of California. You know, that this is the holding tank for the Central Valley Project. So...
And this is where your people are from.
Oh, yeah. Actually. Yeah, this dance ground, this area right here, my great-grandfather lived here. This is his home. This is his village. You know, even then, working for the U.S. Fish Hatchery and keeping his land here, this is how my family survived. You know, my grandma was born on this river, and she grew up here. So there's even fruit trees that he's planted in this campground. They took out some when they made the camp spots and leveled stuff off and moved stuff around here. But there's still the fig tree. There's still the old plum trees that he planted. There's an old apple tree that's down here. And they're still producing. They still have fruit on them. And so when I walk around here, you know, I just feel like, you know, this is my home. This is what should have been given to us when they flooded the lake. And they promised to give us like land. These are the places, our own homes, they should have allowed us to keep. But they didn't, you know, we ended up with nothing here. They got all the land under the lake by promising like land to live on. So where is that? Where's the like land? Otherwise, this land is still ours. They breached the contract. They should give the land back. If they don't want to follow through with the law, because that was a law, that was an act of Congress, they don't want to fulfill it, then everything should revert back to what it was before, which means this is our land. This is my grandpa's land.
Can you tell us a little more about the war dance?
The war dance, right now we are praying, putting down our footprints here, asking the sacred places, asking the sacred mountains to open a way that we will know how to get this done for the Bathos Tonas. And the people that are here, you know, we have a lot of good hearts. We have a lot of people who traveled quite a ways to stand with us, to be with us. And there are certain commitments being made to come back and help us. If we do have to block the river, if this government will not recognize that we have a religious freedom right under any law, even under the First Amendment or American Indian Religious Freedoms Act, or in our own right as a tribe, recognized or not by the federal government as on that list, we're still a tribe. They still know we're a tribe. We've always been here. They have a lot of our things in the museum in Washington, D.C., showing it off that Indians in California. Our things are in every university. Everybody's studying history or linguists or geology or education. They're studying us to get their degrees. Anthropologists, archaeologists, they're all studying our things. And then for them to turn around and say we're not recognized is crazy. That's crazy.
Last question. You mentioned earlier about people in a tribe and being in a tribe and knowing your place. And I understand that you and your husband have separated.
Yep.
The war chief has left the tribe.
Yep.
What is that like for you?
Well, I believe that we were hit. There was a plant that came into our village and disrupted the leadership. The maneuvering of that person within our village split and caused chaos among the elder women, above the young people, and started doing things that people shouldn't do. Like setting it up so that that he was so important, that she was going to do everything, that the tribe didn't really appreciate him. You know, started stroking him in a way that caused this gap and caused such deep hurt, even between him and his daughter, him and his son. Everything started splitting open. And because we had, we've been married over 20 years, you know, we've been together 22 years, that I didn't really see it. And there were certain tribal members that were split off with certain information that afterwards, you know, this person came in as an environmental justice worker for water. And because we had worked with environmental justice for a number of years, that we had a certain amount of trust to work with that organization. And so she came in and said, oh, I want to work with your young people in doing gray water projects in your village. It's like, yeah, that's a good idea. But then she started splitting off everybody and started sorting out. I think she was sorting out, like, where the leadership lies. And even one of the young guys that helped me all the time and helped Mark all the time, that she started singling him out in, you know, I got to go talk to him. I'm going to talk to him. And to the point where he just was confused. He got lost in all of that stuff. And she maneuvered into the middle of stuff. And after it was kind of over, I mean, you know, he went into mental health. He was so confused and so distraught that he was in a mental health facility last summer. After we came back from the UN this time, in July, he went into mental health. And he was in there, and we worked out a deal where he came out and was going to stay in Oregon with our tribal people there, and that we were going to get together and work things out and figure this out, what's going on, what's happened here. She went there and took him off before his counseling even started. She took him for 7 days, and nobody knew where he was. His phone was off. He didn't make any contact for 7 days. And then he went back to Oregon. And I went and I talked with him, and I said, well, you know, I have Indian doctors from Arizona that work with us all the time that are coming to help us. And I wanted him to get doctored. And he said, okay, that I would even bring them to Oregon so that he would, you know, because there's an amount of shame that of what he was doing. There was an amount that I don't think he could face, that what he has, you know, the turn that he had been making, and the hurt of his daughter, everybody, me, you know, everybody, of what he stood for, not only just my husband, but the headman of the tribe, the war dance chief, the helper with ceremony, you know, the interpreter for the language. It's like, it was unbelievable that this was happening to us. And before we could get the doctor up there, she went and got him and took him to Sacramento. And it wasn't like it didn't appear to that he might have called her and said, come get me, I'm going to go live with you. Because he left all his stuff in Oregon. Even his medication, he left it in Oregon, like he was going to come back, but he didn't. And then he just went straight off the cliff, moved in with her. He's like turned his back on everybody. I mean, he's like, he's not Indian anymore. He doesn't have any beliefs anymore. He doesn't have any connection to his own cousin who lives with us. He just went off and left her. You know, she's Down syndrome. His parents took care of her her whole life, and he had made promises that he was going to take care of her. But, you know, his mom and dad recently passed away. And when his dad passed away, there was a break, you know, there was a place in him that was vacant, and that's what she filled. Because she came right after that, right in August. And his dad had just died in June. And so he was still dealing with this loss. And it was prime. It was prime thing to... And it's, to me, it's like all of the emails that popped up later, you know, when we start piecing things together, that who does that? Who comes in as a justice worker to a disadvantaged community and cites themselves with a man that could be her father, who has multiple health problems, who's the leader that's been married traditionally to the chief for 20-some years, who has adult children who live right in the village, and cites themselves and says, oh, I love him. You know, he's going to be my man, and works towards that. Who does that if it's not a plant? And then who goes to Oregon and takes him off when he's been in a mental institute. I wouldn't even take him off by himself and me for 7 days because he's so sensitive. He's so, he was so, you know, they had him on different drugs. They had him, he was so nervous and so unstable. And then goes to get him and takes him to Sacramento. We went to a lobby day for Human Right to Water. She had him sitting in there with her when the whole tribe walks in. Who does that kind of stuff?
So how are you dealing with this?
It's been very difficult, and he's afraid to talk. He doesn't want, I mean, he doesn't want to discuss anything. He doesn't want to explain anything. He doesn't want to have any conversation or anything. It's like he, right now, he stays in her house and that's what he does. He drives her to work because now we addressed EJCW because we think it's wrong for justice organizations to come into disadvantaged communities, tribes, and let their workers do this. And so we held them accountable and said, these are all the things that were inappropriate. Aside from an affair, these are all the things that she should not have done as a justice worker coming in representing their organization. Well, they let her go. But before they let her go, they were doing an investigation from August to October. She goes out and buys a brand new car, a Highlander hybrid Toyota, which are like $45,000 car, right? Who does that when they're about ready to lose their job? When they're under investigation for inappropriate behavior, misrepresenting the organization? Who does that? But you know where she showed up? She works for the governor now. How does that happen? I mean, we tried to do a background check on her, right? And she has a lock on her job history and her finances. Who knows to do that? I mean, why would people do that? You must have had something happen before that you would know to do that. Or is somebody watching out for your image and your ID stuff? Because everybody in the Water Coalition, the environmental justice that we work with, because we're all the way from the Delta up here, working on water issues. No one ever said, you know, Debbie is applying for the governor's job and we should support her or we should give her a recommendation. And environmental justice says that they did not recommend her for that job. And her job listing is that that's the only job that is even on her background that shows that she has worked with disadvantaged communities and tribes. So now she's a community and rural advisor to the governor. Affairs advisor. It's like, oh, that's appropriate.
So are you upset, sad, angry, hurt, distraught?
I'm worried. And that's why I talk about plants and the fact that we have to be aware, you know, that we are, we're sitting here, you know, doing our traditional thing. And you have Westlands, you know, you have big corporations that are capable of interference, are capable of influencing closures of a river, or, you know, it's not unreal for those kinds of things to, and it's new for us. We're not really, you know, we really didn't think that way before. It's like we're just a small tribe trying to hang on to our traditions and do our way of life, but now we're more aware, you know, and yeah, it's hard on all of us. It's all on all, the whole tribe, and we don't know what it's going to turn out in the end, but we're going through it, and at the end of it, you know, maybe it's supposed to be this way. I don't know, but it's understandable now. You know, it's like, it's so crazy. It's crazy. And we just have to go through it and see where do we get to after this, you know, because All of the men are adjusting. All of the young warriors are adjusting. All of the women, the family is adjusting to a change. It's a big change. It's one that we would never, ever have guessed would have happened.
It's not one you have ceremony for, I presume.
No, we don't have ceremony for that. And we don't know. You know, it's like, well, people have choices. And but it would be nice to know that he's making those choices as a normal, regular, you know, human being, and not one that's being coerced and brainwashed and drugged and whatever they do when they go in and do things like that. You know, and it's not acting normal, so it feels like there is an attack, and she is a part of it. Yeah. And what would she do after this? Because, you know, our men don't have a very long life expectancy. And his health is so poor that why would you want to take on somebody? It's not like you can start a new life with him and go on, you know, into the future. He's an elder. You know, he could be a grandpa. Our kids are old enough to have kids. And he's sick. You know, he has health problems. And so now seems like that would be even a liability working for the governor's office. And now she's the co-lead on the California Indian Water Commission, which we're a part of. Why would she want to be that over us again, over disadvantaged communities, when she obviously has no morals or principles or ethics to work with disadvantaged communities? But it's like she's rewarded. I always think like, well, you know what? The next place she'll be is in Washington, D.C. She'll be a lobbyist. That's what they do. They just keep moving them.
Boy, I ought to do an expose about her.
Yeah, go interview her.
So let's see. I think we're going to wrap it up.
Uh-huh.
One thing that comes to mind is something you said a couple days ago about when you decided to take your ceremonies public and to start speaking out about the land that's been flooded, the idea that they want to raise the Shasta Dam, more sacred land that could be flooded, the work to bring back the salmon, to hold your ceremonies in peace, and that Graham said that there would be some struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I remember you saying that, and I imagine, did you ever imagine what kind of struggle that you were
I never imagined that I'd have this personal struggle, as well as all of these things that we're being hit with. You know, and I can understand, too, that people get tired, they get worn out, they get drained, you know, and maybe that is what happened to him, too. But at the same time is that I can't give up. You know, I'm born into this. He isn't. You know, he came into it later on in his life. And maybe he isn't built of that kind of determination or knowing the loss, you know, about these things. But, the Shasta Dam is probably one of the major issues here that we're being attacked about, because we are a tribe. I mean, maybe that's why they don't want to close the river, because they don't want to acknowledge that there is a tribe here who has a way of life, who has ceremonies, who has sacred places that they still go to, and they pray, and they say that's what makes them Winnemem. Without these places, who would we be? How would we be Winnemem? If you take everything away that made us that people, what people do we become? And is that satisfying? You know, to us it's not.
It's a form of cultural, would you say it's a form of cultural genocide?
That's what Westland said when we asked him for the letter for us to use the Puberty Rock. And they said, well, aren't you that tribe that has a lawsuit against this and that? It's like, we do. We are in lawsuits. And we don't think the Delta should be destroyed. And there is a process that we're in support of stopping that. Of course, Westland's is a beneficiary of that. And so they pointed that out. And then they said, and you guys have been saying we're committing cultural genocide. It's like, well, if you don't let us use our rock, yeah, that's cultural genocide. If the Forest Service cannot find a reason to close the river and not allow us to access our ceremony in the way that it should be, that's a form of cultural genocide. Saying that we're unrecognized, you know, creating unrecognized people is a vast form of cultural genocide because you have no rights. I mean, just having these eagle feathers is I don't have the right. Building this fire, we don't have the right. Dancing this dance because there's no religious freedom for us. You know, speaking our language, there's no law that says that we can continue to do that. You know, they want us to put all that down and become something else. But that's not the way we're trained, you know. Grams is from this land right here. My mom and dad are born on this river. You know, we have a connection here that is so recent. It's not like they took us to another country and dumped us off and now we, you know, manage to exist and our future generations are not connected to that which was here before. Yeah. We're not refugees.
Okay, so last question. So thank you, Colleen, for being with us. Thank you, Colleen, for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we wrap it up, we have three questions we ask all of our interviewees. And one is, can you describe a eureka or an aha moment in your life?
Well, I think I had one just the other day when I realized that permit was not going to close the river. It's like, what? That was a separate process. That was a shock because all this time, since 2005, I was thinking that permit was what we really needed to get to close the river. And now it's like, it's not important to get that permit anymore. It doesn't close the river. But I think the other big moment was when Marissa was born and how Grams looked at that. It's like, we're watching this, you know, we're going through it. It's like, at first you say, oh boy, you know, we never expected her to come 3 weeks early. You can't be in labor. Oh yeah, you're in labor. And then it's right at sunrise, and so we're supposed to be doing a ceremony at sunrise, right? Now what are we going to do? This baby's coming right now. And so I go with the baby. Grams does the sunrise ceremony. And then the baby, we find out, is coming out feet first. You know, you're going through all of these things, but you don't know that when you get back and what the spirit world says about that, that you've just witnessed the next leader of the tribe coming into the world. And you didn't even know it. I mean, it wasn't like we were pre-warned to say, oh yeah, she's carrying the next baby. But it doesn't work that way. You know, it's like, those are like big moments to realize that that had just happened.
And what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
I think that I would be happy if we would be seen as real people with a real religion and able to access our places and keep the Winnemem. I think that's important. I mean, every time the world loses a culture, I think everybody in the world loses. You know, and that's what I don't want to do. I want the Winnemem to continue on into the future. The way that we have things, the little bit that we have left, we need to hang on to that. Because these acorn trees need it. We still have to get our salmon back in this river. You know, we've got a lot of work to do. But I don't know. We're a rich tribe in culture compared to a lot of other people. So even though we're going through hard times and heartache and losses, you know, we have everything everybody else has. You know, we have a high mortality rate. We have a death rate of our men, early age. We're not escaping anything, you know, that happens to all the tribes. But we also have that fire. We have those songs. We have those war dances. We have good hearts. We have a loving group. I mean, when I hear people say, I'm thankful for the people who welcomed me in here, it makes my heart feel good because I know that's my people. That they felt good and they said those things to those people. And not because they're trying to impress them, but because they feel that way. And this is the reason why, that we have these ceremonies. So that above all of our hurt and all of our struggles, all of the things that are happening to us, like raising the lake, getting our salmon back, the PG&E up on the upper river, trying to make a fish passage, you know, trying to be people, that still we have a lot of humor, we have a lot of laughter, we have a lot of love, we have a lot of caring for each other. And that in itself is, you know, that's the right thing to do. Whatever we're doing the right thing because we have that, you know.
And is there a book you could recommend?
A book? Winnie the Pooh. I don't really read books, but I have read Winnie the Pooh, and there are certain episodes like people, even the Lorax. I think the Lorax has a message that people need to understand and feel. But I always remember Winnie the Pooh when he gets the balloon and he floats up and gets the honey out of the tree, and then he can't get down. He's still hanging on to the balloon and he can't get down. And Christopher Robin is walking up and down under the tree, and he goes, because he's there helping Winnie the Pooh pretend to be a rain cloud so the bees won't know, right? And so then he calls down to Christopher and says, I can't get down. And Christopher says, well, let go of the balloon. He goes, I can't let go. Well, you got to let go to get down. He goes, well, you get your slingshot and break the balloon because I can't let go of it. And it's like, I look at that as what people are. It's like they can't let go, like these boaters. They can't let go of that for 4 days until it's taken from them. But it's the same result. And it would be much better if you could just let go of it because the result is the same. You know, sometimes we're that way, you know. It's like can't let go of it until it's taken from us. And sometimes we even do that to our own kids. That we're hanging on to them so tight that when we do let go of them, they're broken. You know, they have to be broken. Then we say, you know, like, I don't know how they got that way.
Well, Colleen, thanks for being with us. I'm really curious.
Okay, thank you.